the road. Say goodbye so long. Farewell. Bye bye.
And we're having a little technical difficulty with that great big band song. And thanks very much to Bill for being our big band DJ again this Friday morning. We're going to proceed right on time now with the new WHFR Journal. This is WHFR Dearborn from Henry Ford Community College, a station making waves, WHFR.FM. The new WHFR Journal is coming right up. Hi, this is WHFR, WHFR.FM from Henry Ford Community College. We're live in the studio today with another edition, the January 16th, 2009 edition of the new WHFR Journal. Why is it new? Because we're going to say stuff we didn't say last week, that's why. But we cover local news and alternative views. What's going on in the community, what matters most to you, is probably right next door. And one of the things that's right next door to Henry Ford Community College is University of Michigan Dearborn and a couple of great community resources. One of them is the Environmental Center and the nature area behind it. And we have with us today in the studio Dr. Oren Gelderoos, who is the director of the Environmental Interpretive Center at the University of Michigan Dearborn campus. So welcome this afternoon, Dr. Gelderoos.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Okay. I think your microphone is turned up adequately. That's always a good thing. We have a special guest. You are a professor of biology and a professor of environmental studies. You teach both area of classes at the University of Michigan Dearborn. And I think it's great that there is, first of all, an environmental studies program. Obviously, it's very difficult because it has to be so comprehensive. I mean, botany, zoology, and maybe geology, it all has to be sort of wrapped together. Maybe you want to just talk briefly about the content of that program, and as I keep getting from my students as first week of classes, what are the career opportunities?
Well, the environmental studies program complements the environmental sciences program as well. And the environmental studies program then goes even beyond the natural sciences into geography, it goes into environmental ethics, which is in philosophy, it goes into education, which is environmental interpretation, which is part of the name of our center, and in many of the social and behavioral sciences as well. So it's very broad, and so when students are finished with this program, they can take on a host of different assignments. One of our current graduates now is the director of the international program between Canada and the United States, and she's a regional director of that. One of our graduates is a director of the environment for the Southeast Michigan Council of Governments at time. Mm-hmm. So they're in leadership positions, and they are able to synthesize and look at the big, broad issues of the environment, and as well as understand the reductionistic mechanics of how the world works.
Yeah, things aren't as simple as some people thought years ago, certainly not the economic system in our country, where there's actually sort of an ecology of the economy, too. I mean, there's so many factors that that get involved. I mean, one of the questions that keep coming up about that is that, you know, how could so many people do such bad investments? How could their logic, all of their education fail them? And in some cases, they were just maybe stupid, or overly greedy, you know, and nefarious purposes. I'm glad you mentioned ethics as part of the environmental studies program. But in fact, it may have to do with, deeper concerns and of many perspectives and many different things. It's not just about the economy. It's about the environment and the weather, and it's so these sorts of things lead to what used to be called a Renaissance man or the ideal liberal arts curriculum, where you really have to know a little bit about everything and be able to pull it all together, you know, and make some sense of it all in order to take good action for the future. So congratulations on all your efforts over there in those programs, which nothing more important than life, and life is part of not only biology, but also the world we live in too. But you're here specifically to make us more aware of the Environmental Interpretive Center, and that is the building that is, how would you describe it, the sort of northwest corner of the University of Michigan Dearborn campus, actually. Just not far away from the a lot of people might be familiar with the sort of biking or hiking or jogging path that went in several years ago, mm-hmm. and that goes right past there, certainly. But, you know, some people may assume that, like, in this weather, there's nothing happening, and there's a lot happening all the time there, and, of course, you're the director of it. So, first of all, let's talk about the nature forest, the nature area itself. A lot of people may not be aware of how large it is. Maybe they only went on that path, and that path goes through a little bit of its, the corner of it, you might say, as you proceed towards Ford Road and Outer Drive and that, but it's not really the whole area. How large is that nature area?
Well, the Environmental Interpretive Center is the gateway to the natural area. That's why the building was built. We don't want people to stay in the Interpretive Center. What we want to have is people get out of the Interpretive Center into the natural area.
Okay.
And the campus itself has 70-some acres of natural area, but it is indistinguishable from the total of 300 acres, which is floodplain between Ford Road and Michigan Avenue. Mm-hmm. And the university has a legal contract with Wayne County, which is the legal guardian of the floodplain area. And we have the contract to have this open to the public so that we can educate the citizens of Wayne County and Southeast Michigan. This is one of the goals of Wayne County. Mm-hmm. And we're very appreciative of the support that they've given us over the years. And we are happy to, in turn, educate the general public as well as our own students and school children as an outreach program of the university for the county.
I thought it's totally natural, and it's a great thing, too, is that in the spring or spring-summer semesters at U of MD, you were telling me earlier that as the as a professor in those areas there, that you actually have special classes that involve people, take them out there all the time, really, to understand, explore directly what's going on in that nature area.
Well, because we have this natural area on the campus, we're able to offer a course called Field Biology.
Mm-hmm.
We've offered it now for over 40 years, and the course has been very, very successful because this is the best time of the year to study the spring wildflowers, mm-hmm. which we hope people will learn to develop and grow in their own yards and make their yards like Southeast Michigan. And also, this is a spring bird migration. And many thousands of birds see this natural area from the sky, and it's just one great big green island where they can come and refuel on their flight to their nesting grounds in the north or to the wintering grounds during the fall season down in either South America or the southern part of the United States. So the field biology course is very popular at that time of the year. In fact, it's so popular that we have to have two sections of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's difficult to believe that college students will be on a waiting list for a class that starts at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my goodness.
And yes. We go 6 to 10, and another group joins us at 9 for an overlap session, and then they exit at about 1 o'clock. And so it's very busy every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I have the privilege of being in the field for 7 hours straight. and this is something that very few people have the opportunity to do.
Well, in ideal weather, in terms of like hiking paths or getting close to nature, I don't know how many miles, you probably know how many miles of paths, I mean, that run back and forth and through this area. It's so much that you can get lost. I mean, if you don't know where you're going, I'd recommend folks, if you try to, and we're not talking about the asphalt paved path, we're talking about the natural forest path that, because they're used a little bit, you can sort of follow them in good weather and wind your way through. But you can get lost. This is many years ago, but I didn't have a map, and I think I was out there a couple of hours before I found my way back out. So it is a lot, but that's a wonder. It's a large area, and it's quite diverse. I mean, there is, although maybe it's part of the Henry Ford estate, the lake, the Hidden Lake, and of course the river, stream, whatever, that runs through there, and there's quite a variety of territory. One is more, would you say, a meadow or a pasture area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have the meadow, which is part of the Jensen landscape, which was a landscape architect that Henry Ford hired to landscape the area, which was once a cornfield. Mm-hmm. And we have at that time now, with the genius of Jens Jensen, what we call a mesic forest. And this is a forest which is now has very tall trees in it, over 100 feet. And it's a forest that is between the wetland and the upland, a sandy-type forest that you find up in Oakland County, where there are oak trees.
Oh, of course.
We don't have so very many oak trees here, but we have a lot of sugar maple trees. Mm. And then down in the floodplain of the Rouge River, we have a sugar bush. This is where there are hundreds and hundreds of sugar maple trees. It's the most popular tree there, since I have identified, counted, and measured every one of them. And this is where we tap the trees in February. In fact, on February the 14th, we're having a public tapping program from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And the public can come out and join with us and put some taps in the trees and hang the bags on the trees, and then step back and watch the sap, well, not really flow, but drip into the bags. And they can come out and help us collect the sap as well at 4 o'clock in the afternoons when it's sunny and cold at night, and that helps the sap flow.
There's not enough, or maybe it's not the right kind of trees to actually have a maple sugar industry in Michigan, is there?
I haven't heard
of Michigan maple sugar. I mean, even Vermont and New Hampshire, that are known for their maple syrup and so on, are having some problems. I guess it's the ecology or the weather or something, acid rain or something. But we have the trees, and we can see all those natural processes going on.
Well, further north, we actually have a maple syrup industry.
Oh,
it's more like a cottage industry, I would say.
Yeah, sure, just if you have a big farm or something.
Right. But we do the boiling down also outside of the Interpretive Center on our demonstration building in the back. And in a fairly good year, we can have maybe 19 to 20-some gallons of syrup that we boil down, and we bottle it in little bottles and use it as giving it to favors.
Some people might think that the only way to, you know, get close to like trees or nature is in maybe the Greenfield Village, the Henry Ford Greenfield Village area. That I know they have a little sort of model farm from the 19th century, but in fact it's the Environmental Interpretive Center and the nature area that where you can really get close to the natural process. And maybe you use the term already, but the forest is just large enough, I understand, or that may be somewhat debatable, to sustain itself in these natural processes.
Well, that's the point of our natural area, is that we hope that this is sustainable and will carry on in perpetuity. And it is large enough for that. It's not a park where we cut all the vegetation below the trees. It's a natural area, so we have the herbaceous layer on the ground, we have the saplings with the trees that are going to replace the ones that fall down. So we don't worry if a tree falls down. Yeah. We've got the replacements ready to go.
Just we cover a number of political issues, and every now and then, every 4 or 5 years, there's some plan that somebody puts out that they actually want to like cut right on through the forest and pave it or something and put picnic benches all over the place. Now, that would, of course, ruin this sort of natural, self-supporting nature area, wouldn't you think? Or are you open to some efforts like that?
Well, that was an issue back in 1970.
Yes, I know. I was there. That was a big blow up.
And we had the people of Dearborn vote on it on a referendum to extend Hines Drive, and they voted against it by 85%.
Yes, I remember that's the full story now, yes.
Unprecedented.
So you don't think anybody's going to try that again?
No, we don't expect that to happen again. We have the agreement with Wayne County to serve the public with education in the area, and I think with the difference in attitude that we have in the couple of generations since that time, we are seeing the world much differently.
Right. The whole idea is, in fact, I think it's some sort of the core meaning of the words that make up ecology. I know there was a poet, who I guess is still alive, from the Beat Generation, Gary Snyder, that he referred to it always as earth household. In other words, taking care of the earth, not exploiting it, not killing it off, but finding ways to live with it and enhance it, which therefore that, since we live in the same environment, it helps to enhance us too. So it's a respect, a trading of respect.
Definitely.
And that's what we have to learn these days again, I think, because we've been doing too many terrible things to our environment,
right,
and even to each other. And that, maybe that sort of ecological respect can change our awareness about how we relate to other human beings too. I mean, I hate to wax philosophical here, so I'll stop. But tell us.
No, but you make a very good point, if I may suggest, and that you are correct that the word ecology and economics have the same root, and it means house.
Mm-hmm.
Ecology means to study the house. Economics means to manage the house. And if you're going to manage something, it seems to me that you better study it first so you know what you're managing.
Wow, absolutely.
And then you not only have to add that to your values or your ethic. What is it you value and what is it you believe? And that's what we take a look at in our environmental studies program as well.
So the programs, let's just sort of conclude our interview. And I really think it's great that you walked over here today from U of MD. And he had very rosy cheeks, folks, when he got in here. But we're only like a 3 to 5 minute walk between campuses. And some of our students do have dual enrollment, share classes and curriculum. And it's I know in good weather, certainly, I always try to get about a half an hour walk every day. And you have it's just a beautiful, exciting place to walk, the nature area, as well as, of course, the bike path. And even I have to compliment the University of Michigan Dearborn campus. Your landscaping people use a lot of what appears to be natural and seasonal plantings. It's not totally natural, but I'm just saying it's a beautiful area to discover and to even just get a little exercise walking around, but especially the nature area with the educational component. First of all, it is open. The nature area is open daily.
Every day, sunrise to sunset.
Sunrise, sunset. And the environmental center itself, where they can get more information about that area, and maybe a map so they don't get lost, is 10 to 5 daily. Now, daily means also Saturday and Sunday.
That's right. Every day of the week.
Okay. Okay, not just, because sometimes they say daily and they think, oh, it's just weekdays.
Right.
Okay, so it's every day, folks. Maybe you have time off for Christmas and New Year's, but...
Well, I was there every day during the break as well, and
great.
If people showed up, I was the host for them during the holiday break.
That's wonderful. And obviously, if it is a holiday, maybe it's a chance for people to get out of their usual routine and explore something else, and so that's very commendable. And about each month from the schedule I see here, in addition to the usual programs and maybe other things that come up, and we'll try to keep our listeners, of course, on top of some of these things as best we can with your local, certainly monthly activities. This month, let's hope it gets a little warmer out there, folks, but there's a Saturday, January 31st. And these are, I think they're all Saturday programs that you have here on this list. But Saturday, January 31st from 10 to noon, 10 a.m. to noon, something called Winter Wildlife. Talk about that.
Well, this is our HSI program. Our habitat scene investigation, and we're going to be checking out what the animals are doing at that time by following their footprints that they leave in the snow. As I ride into the campus on the bicycle trail, each day I see the tracks of the deer, I see tracks of dog animals, it could be fox, it could be coyote, and they see the tracks of the squirrels in the area. And you follow the pathways, and you find out whether they're being chased or whether they're chasing something.
Wow. Cool.
And you can interpret their behavior based on the tracks. And so that's what we're going to be looking at and seeing what activity has been there in the last evening, the last night, and the last week.
They don't need reservations?
You just show up at
10 a.m.
in the afternoon.
This says 10 a.m. here for the winter wildlife.
I'm sorry? It should be 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock.
Okay. Just like the tapping that you mentioned.
That's right.
1 to 3. Okay.
All right.
We'll get that right when we mention it again. 1 to 3 in the afternoon. Okay. Give people a chance to wake up there on Saturday morning.
Oh, and it'll be a little bit warmer. It's not as bitter cold as it might be in the morning.
That's cute. HSI, just like CSI on television. But
right.
Habitat scene investigation. Cool. Okay. And you mentioned the tapping resources. That's about the sugar maple trees, and that's going to be Saturday, February 14th. What a great, as you point out in your press release here, Valentine's Day, a sweet time to come out and look at the maple sugar trees. And I think it would be great. I think it would be a great activity. And that's Saturday, February 14th. And you even talk about joining the SAP squad. What is that?
Well, there's a SAP drips. It fills up the SAP collecting bags, and we get maybe 70, 80 gallons of SAP on a good day. We have to take a cart, put it in a large container, and pull the cart back up the hill and all the way to the interpretive center, and it takes a lot of work.
Now, that's not just on the 14th as I read this. That's once the SAP starts flowing, maybe in late February or whatever. It looks like it's every day the SAP is dripping?
That's right.
At 4 p.m.?
That's right.
Wow.
Come at 4 p.m. with your good boots on so that you don't get wet through the mud that might be there.
Sure, yeah.
And help us collect the SAP and haul the cart with the big barrel of it in.
And I love this part, folks. To thank collectors for their efforts, volunteers are invited to a pancake breakfast at the center to be held after the sugaring season concludes. So when do you think that's going to start? Is it on your website that you mentioned when that begins, or is it February 14th?
February 14th is
official
set the taps.
Kickoff, if you will.
That's right.
Okay.
And if the listeners have school groups that they would like to come and school classes, they're welcome to schedule a program, and the students in the class can set some taps in the trees as well.
Right.
And we have a very good program on the maple sapping and the sugar maple trees, and we take a look at the three B's called the bark, the branches, and the buds. And this ties in with students' science curriculum.
Sure. And you can work out the – I see a lot of course, school buses over there throughout the week. And so field trips, you love them. And there's really no charge for the
no.
Well,
this
the
is,
school
again,
groups coming
our,
in?
Our
mm-hmm.
Outreach
wonderful.
To the community.
Mm-hmm.
The university pays our staff people, and we pay our students to be trained and to be good educators. And they inspire our visitors to understand the ecological processes that we have in that area.
And you do have activities, just very briefly, in Saturday, March 7th, maple sugar, but there's other things too, it says. It's called Sweet Endings. Is that the pancake breakfast?
No, that'll be a program on the syrup, because we'll have syrup boiling down at
that
time.
Oh, okay. So that's sort of the next stage.
So you can come
syrup.
And taste the syrup and sample the product that comes from the maple trees.
Okay. And so almost each month, every month, there's something special on like a Saturday, as well as the ongoing programs that that happen. And, of course, you're always welcoming people just to come in individually or in groups to walk through the nature area, but also look at the displays inside the Interpretive Center, too. Just one last point about this. As long as they know where it is there, U of MD campus, and the website that I found, I think if they just get to uofmd.umich.edu, they can find the Interpretive Center, the Environmental Interpretive Center schedule and activities pretty easily.
That's correct.
So it's uofmd.umich, that is UMICH .edu. And of course, there is a great phone number, 593-5338, that will help them. And if they need directions or whatever there, or even anywhere on the campus, they can probably, everybody probably over there knows where it
sure.
is. They can point out the area. Sort of northwest corner there of the north side of the campus, the side that's sort of closest to the south part of Henry Ford Community College. And you easily can see the center if you happen to be on that bike path, jogging path, the asphalt path that runs from West Dearborn up to, connects with that outer drive path that goes to Plymouth eventually.
That's correct. It goes out Hines Drive.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So, but I wanted to give a final plug for the fact that you're to make the center what it is and do better. You're always welcoming people to come in and volunteer their time to learn and educate and be part of your staff to help the center. And of course, WHFR here, if it wasn't for our 60 plus volunteers like Ned Apigian, who we'll hear the voice of shortly when we get back to our news format in the show, and Bill Wright, who just left, if it wasn't for our volunteers, we couldn't have this community resource going either. And if someone wanted to come in and find out about the center and felt they had some time to help or maybe some background already in, I don't know, biology or science, you'd be glad to talk to them?
We talk with anybody and everybody we can.
Work out their schedule?
It's our responsibility that we have to educate the people of Southeast Michigan.
Obviously, it's a natural for many of your students over there in these environmental mm-hmm. program, biology program, to come over and volunteer some time. But people in the community would be helpful. And I assume you have several, if not dozens, at one time or another that give their time to the program.
Yes, we do. We're very happy and thankful for them.
Mm-hmm. As well as, and this is how we made contact originally, Peg King, who's the wife of Ishmael Ahmed, who Peg started the World Music Show here on WHFR about 15 years ago when we first got on the air, and then got an art teacher's degree from U of M Dearborn, and apparently she still comes in and helps the Environmental Center too at times with everything else she's involved in.
Yes, amazing woman.
It's wonderful. So again, folks, we're talking about the University of Michigan Environmental Interpretive Center, which is part of the nature area. The forest, the meadow, and so on, that's was part of the former Henry Ford estate and were owned by Henry Ford originally. Their phone number is 593-5338. So, Dr. Gelderus, thanks so much for coming by today on the new WHFR Journal. We really do appreciate your coming by and giving the word, and we'll stay in touch. Okay.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you.
A leader in education in your community, Henry Ford Community College has provided excellence and innovation in education since 1938. We're proud to have launched the careers of thousands of students both in Michigan and around the world. Celebrate the 70th anniversary of Henry Ford Community College by becoming a student today. Achieve your dreams, and it starts with a visit to hfcc.edu or by calling 1-800-585-HFCC. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
And we're back with more of the new WHFR Journal for today, January the 16th, 2009. And I want to thank again Dr. Gelderus for coming by and telling us about the U of M D Interpretive Center. It is open now, but you certainly have to bundle up before you go out there on those trails. And, you know, it's not a big mechanized Disneyland thing. It's got real snow and real ice and real mud. And
pathways.
Yeah, that's right. And Ned is here. Let's get your mic up, Ned. Go ahead. And they do have pathways, but they're not, like, prepared and you know, cleared for you.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
I was wondering what they thought about it when they built that housing project, which was a gigantic meadow before they built the golf course and that TPC thing. I remember when that was a field.
We might be thinking of a different. We're talking about the area that's right next to the college here.
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't connect to there, maybe.
No. The only building that's on that particular area, which again we're talking about the former, well, even Henry Ford Community College and U of MD, it was formerly all land and part of the contiguous land owned by Henry Ford.
Right. His estate.
His estate. Yeah. And so we're on Henry Ford estate land, as is U of MD, but his estate itself does have its contiguous or right next door to the nature area, and is part of that. And people can take a tour for money down there. But the much larger areas, this nature area, that's the forest and the meadows.
Is that west of his house?
It's west and mostly north.
Oh, mostly north.
Yeah, because the estate, if everybody knows where the Henry Ford Mansion is, It's you just keep going north on that road, okay? Just keep going past it, go north on the road. And before you turn again to sort of leave the U of MD campus, you'll see the Environmental Interpretive Center right in that corner.
The kind of wood, yeah. A building they, made out of wood.
And they everything. Do say, and people say, well, I don't know where to park at a college, and there's all that. Well, apparently,
parking structure.
Yeah, there's a parking structure right near it, and they say it's free for people that want to go in there and park for the Environmental Center. I mean, that's what it says on the website. So I didn't mention that earlier, so I thought I'd mention that. So there's plenty of parking near there, even though they don't have a lot per se right at the Environmental Center. So just bundle up if you want to go out there today.
And wander around at your pleasure? Is that the idea?
Get a map, as I said, because the trails, which are probably visible even with the snow on the ground, because Dr. Geller was telling me before, is that people that know the area, they love to go out there any time of the year and the season and see what's happening with the forest and the animals, and because it is real natural. It's not man-made. It's not massaged, and the animals aren't corralled or pushed to the side or even, and I didn't ask this, but I don't even think that they feed them. They don't have to. It wouldn't make
any sense.
No, the forest is self-contained. It right. has its own foodstuffs, and the animals live off what the forest naturally produces. That's the whole idea. That's how the animals got there in the first place. And so it is just a big enough area that allows the trees and all the wildlife to maintain life there on their own, independent. I mean, perfect ecology, the life and the
I'm sure
and
that's
the plants.
What it is.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a wonderful opportunity. So
I wonder why one of the local newspapers doesn't give an article about it with a map showing the grounds and where to go and what's there to encourage people. Once you see it in the local press, you'd say, oh, my God, this is like Greenfield Village, but another kind of historical...
It's a totally free wilderness area that does have the interpretive center. If you want to know what's going on or you want to get a map, I mean, it is a tremendous natural resource. It's a real thing, folks, in other words. I know when I was in Florida a few years back, I went to, of course, Disney World and to their sort of science area, Tomorrowland, or whatever they called it, down there in Disney World, Epcot Center science stuff. And, all about science and the moon and rocket ships. And they tried to give you a little education. But then I thought, not that far away. I'm going to go over to the Kennedy Space Center, which is Cape Canaveral, again, it's called. But they give tours of that, too. And it's just maybe an hour and a half drive east of Orlando area. And it was the real thing. It was the real thing. And
I'd like to go to... I worked on the design of Rocket Pad B there, never went over there. I'd like to go over there and watch one of those takeoffs.
Well, the sad thing is the real thing is run on a shoestring budget. Folks are astronauts and everything else, and it's not all that shiny and polished. And there's no great interpretive center. They take you into a warehouse hangar, and put you on bleachers to talk to you before they walk you around. And, they got a little gift shop, but it's not like the Disney World gift shops, you know what I mean?
No, I didn't know that. They have that at the...
At the Space Center, yeah, right. Oh, it's cool, but it's humbling. These people are out there in outer space, and they've been to the moon, and we're probably going back, and they're risking their lives. And it's. I'm not saying they hold it together with chewing gum and duct tape, but it's almost, And it's so noble an endeavor, I think, and they're dealing directly with the real outer space, not the real world, but in a way, it's the real world. It's part of the universe. It's what surrounds the Earth and our moon and so on. And it is so exciting in a non-glitzy way. And that's what I would say about the U of M, the Interpretive Center, the Nature Center. It's totally exciting because man didn't make it that way.
Well, he mentioned this Jens landscape architect that Ford hired for some purpose. I didn't know that story either.
Yeah, well, in terms of the Ford Mansion, I just learned this yesterday by going to the website, umich.edu, right. And the Ford estate itself, I knew there was a lake back there, that was dug by a steam shovel. Henry Ford had an architect. He said, I think we need a lake for birds and things. And so I guess there was a stream, but there's a way you could dig it so that the water would sort of back up. And he does have a dam. He's got a dam there, too.
Oh, the dam I've seen.
Keep the water, and it backed it up into the lake. But he had to dig that area out to make it a lake. you know.
And did you see it from this end? I've never seen a lake there.
From the Ford Mansion? Yeah, you can walk. You have to walk through the woods. You can't see it from the Henry Ford Estate.
Oh.
Yeah, and I recommend good weather. But,
Not today.
Going back to your comment about the Press and Guide and the Times Herald coming back into their circulation this month, a couple weeks off just because there's less news over the holidays. But of course,
and I noticed they have
the sad news is that, of course, as we did a tribute show last week, Frank Bewick did pass away, and he was the founder, along with a couple other business people, but he was the founder and publisher for since the.
So they're a little bit behind themselves.
Since 63, of that. It's great if the papers had the space, and, you know, every page in a newspaper costs them money to, and they have a responsibility to publish things, and they got to have ads to pay for the paper. But more information about the Environmental Interpretive Center and other ongoing activities is a very important thing. So we'll try to keep on top of that and mention as that sort of thing goes on, especially because even U of MD is not making any money directly off of it. It's free. You know, I mean, the Interpretive Center, the nature area is
they
free.
They just own it.
They're managing the property, yeah.
Or is it a part of the foundation?
Even the estate that was turned over to the management of U of MD is the Ford family or the foundation that runs, the Edison Foundation, as it's called. It's actually the Ford Family
you
Foundation
Greenfield
that
Village.
Runs Greenfield Village. Henry, do they ultimately own it and are just leasing it to U of MD, or is the ownership given to them with the expectation in perpetuity they're going to take care of it?
But the tours,
it doesn't matter.
Right. The tours there never include the home. It's kind of like separate.
If you go, the home has its own tours. You can't just walk in and walk around.
You can rent space in there too for weddings and receptions.
Oh yeah, they do that a lot. And even on the grounds in good weather, you can get married on the grounds. Whatever. Well, I'm going to look at the news here now with Ned here. He'll straighten us out.
I don't know about that, but it was an interesting thing. We're talking about Greenfield Village. There was a fire there that destroyed a historic building and. Yeah. Thank God it only affected a home called named the owner Sarah Jordan, was built in 1870.
Yeah, apparently, and they brought it in from, I guess, New Jersey, wherever the original Menlo Park lab was of
all
Edison.
That stuff came
but it had been a place where some of the people who worked at the Menlo Park lab stayed. I mean, it's part of a boarding house. Yeah,
and so it wasn't really significant, but.
Yeah, it's part of history, and now it's gone, I guess, or it has to be rebuilt or something. That's sad. But nobody was hurt for
maybe
that.
Maybe it's
goodness.
Not important enough to have spend the money to be rebuilt.
I thought, and I wanted to just cover a couple of topics quickly here, from the Times Herald from this Wednesday, the January 14th, on the front page, controversial article, but the Michigan Leadership Institute, which is part of a larger assessment, did an assessment of district procedures and practices as requested by Dearborn Public School Superintendent Brian Winston after he came in this May and was hired this May.
The language issue?
Yeah, yes. They claim that students learning English as a second language are bringing down overall achievement at the city's three public high schools. And that's an independent report that was released this week. In other words, the effort at bilingual education in all the classrooms, sort of like mainstreaming students. So
we
like,
already learned that already from the Spanish issue in California.
Well, you can just imagine if a teacher has to teach the same principal in two languages at the same time because he has some people who are still speaking a non-native language and not, you know, non-English language mostly. They're learning, they're taking classes to learn English as quickly as possible. English is a second language. But in order to understand science and math and so on, the teacher has to spend the time to speak, really give two classes at once, which slows down the instruction for both the Arabic and the English
they're
students.
They're trying to have a science teacher teach science in Arabic? The same person?
Well, as I understand, it's a limited, I'm sure, a limited number of teachers that can do bilingual instruction. But the concept is either have separate sections of the same classes for the Arabic students and separate them from the English students. But in fact, and it's a basic principle of language instruction, folks, I took French as a foreign language and was almost a double major, forgotten a lot now, but almost a double major both in my undergraduate and in my first master's degree, where I also took graduate level French. Total immersion is the only way to go. So if you want students here in Dearborn, in America, to learn English quickly, yes, they need some supplemental instruction about English, you know, in their own language perhaps, but all the other classes, all the other basic instruction needs to be in English. Oh, it's tough on them. It's tough on them, certainly, if they don't quite understand, but they're going to learn English faster because they have to. And nobody's saying that Arab-speaking students are not as smart as and we think they can manage it. And this study, and I'm sure several other foreign language groups of foreign language experts, know that total immersion is the fastest way to go. Now, of course, parents would be very helpful if they would speak English as much as possible at home to help their students, to help their children learn English quicker, too. But whatever the limits are there, nobody's saying that parents need to do it one way or the other.
How about a real experience? And I'm talking from personal experience and people that I know, not only myself.
Mm-hmm.
My older sisters, which are about 14, 15 years older than me, when they went to school, they did not know English. And there was no effort to teach anybody, all these immigrant children. I lived in a red-line district where they even bussed in Indians from an Indian reservation to give you an idea how bad that district was.
Well, yeah.
Not only it was the blackest district in the city we lived in, if that made that's important. And you are just immersed in English. When you couldn't speak a word of English, you went to, and nobody made any attempt to do anything else. You learn English real fast. And young children, from my own experience, I have grandchildren that are bilingual. And that little kid will look at you and sense that you don't know his second language that he's been taught. He will speak to you in English. If he thinks you know the foreign language that you speak in the house as a second language. So this is a silly idea. It's a waste of time and money. All it does is make sure that the immigrants stay immigrant. Living here, sometimes I think every day is Halloween. There's no reason to be walking around.
It's true. It makes things a little bit easier for the students, but it slows down their instruction and their learning of English, as well as the rest of the English-speaking students. And I'll just read two paragraphs and just leave it at that, folks. There's going to be further discussions. They're not stopping bilingual education. The article goes on to say that that we have one of the best bilingual programs in the state of Michigan, but the effect on the total learning of both non-native speaking English students and the English-speaking students is a problem. It's a serious problem. And here's what it says. The report concluded that the district's relatively high segment of ESL, or English as a Second Language students, has had a sinking effect on overall test scores, and coupled with an influx of African Americans and other ethnic groups, could make meeting federally mandated progress benchmarks difficult in coming years. Failing to meet the requirements could eventually mean sanctions as outlined by federal No Child Left Behind or newly proposed state legislation, such as the new high school graduation requirements.
What's that? Something.
Well, they're much tougher. There's a lot of specific areas, science, I think even language and foreign language instruction, but there's much, in other words, you can't get out of high school with an easy degree anymore. It has to be a well-balanced degree in difficult subjects, math and science, as well as the other important areas.
You know, I went to school in New York State, and they had a system called Regents testing.
Yes.
You could choose to take the New York State Regents exams or not. But if you wanted to go to college, it would behoove you to take the Regents exam.
Yeah, many other states, most other states have.
I don't know, in Michigan, we don't have that system.
Much more effective state, let's say, management of public schools. For years, Michigan did nothing to set standards or to foster appropriate education at different levels. And I'm not saying that the state government or the federal government should dictate everything, that the rights of local schools and neighborhood associations and parents are somewhat being stepped on these days because of these regulations. Certainly No Child Left Behind. I've criticized that many, many times as a great concept, but a terribly poorly worked out and funded and supported federal initiative. And we'll see what happens with the new federal government there. Well, but the other paragraph I just wanted to share, and then we'll go to other stories, though, and let Ned make a comment if he wants to. But to remedy those problems, the review team suggests putting bilingual students into the general curriculum as quickly as possible, while also refraining from speaking Arabic in the classroom unless necessary, unless absolutely necessary, I would say. Because, believe me, folks, it's going to be faster for them and better for all the students at the school who are not non-native speakers. But, hey, that's my point of view as someone who's studied a foreign language extensively and has talked and related to foreign language teachers for many, many years. And even the U.S. government, when they teach foreign languages to people in their language training institutes, it's total immersion, folks. It's the only way you can get it, as Ned said, too, although I think that for the ESL students, they also have to learn English writing standards, you know, grammar standards and so on. So they need separate classes in English as a written language in order to catch up. But, yeah, the total immersion will certainly help with their colloquial, their spoken language, and has to be that way if it's going to happen quickly or accurately or fairly even for everybody concerned. So, of course, nobody listened to my opinion for years and years, but now we have this official report, and we'll see how it works out, and we'll see what the city of Dearborn has done. I did congratulate Superintendent Brian Winston for all of these independent reviews that he initiated when he came in, and now we have to take the findings and see how to incorporate them in the city, appropriate to the city, because independent reviewers and experts don't know Dearborn specifically, but these are principles that I can certainly say need to be looked at, if not implemented.
Well, you know, that report has a very short sentence that I think captures the issue. Mm-hmm. It says, "It is our belief that the use of languages other than English slows the process of students being acculturated into the school and the American society in mm-hmm. general."
Yeah,
and after all, that's the whole point of the school, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly debate, too, if you want to get to the federal level, about whether or not English should be the official language of the United States. There actually, my understanding is, there is no such
right
principle rule. It's not in the Constitution or whatever. But as the other large and diverse countries like India knows, and India,
they use English.
Know, the British forced it on them. You know, oh, everybody's going to learn English in all 60 of your separate cultures. They have 60 separate languages and cultures, not dialects, but 60 separate languages, cultures throughout India.
And English saves them.
And English has actually allowed them to become unified and get together and work together on common needs with all their millions, if not billions, of people that live in India. It really is an advantage to have a common language that's mandated by law. Now, people can still learn their own regional languages all they want to,
that's right,
and study them in addition to, but English is the common core language, and that really helped them. And in this country, we probably should do something like that. No disrespect to all the
absolutely
other cultures.
Amen.
You know, well,
you know, my daughter was a foreign exchange student in from Dearborn High some 30 years ago, I think. No, something 25 or so. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about it was you didn't know where you were going and you couldn't pick where you were going. Well, guess what? In 10 months, my daughter did not know a word of German. She didn't even know she was going to end up in Germany.
Oh.
She ended up with a German family that's fluent in English, still sends us Christmas cards and letters in perfect English.
Huh.
My daughter, in 10 and a half months, spoke fluent German and came home and said, "Dad, I hate to tell you, I think in German now." And it
wow
didn't take
yeah
long. So you're trying to tell me these kids born and raised in America that have a foreign language spoken in their home cannot go to school and in a year become proficient in English?
Well, it certainly should be possible. There may be reasons
why. That's my own experience,
you know,
at home.
Yeah, as long as the family understands, too, and is supportive of English, and maybe even tries to learn a little more English themselves, one way or the other. Which, by the way, folks, we have a wonderful English as a Second Language Institute for adults and for young people, too, if they want to sign up for it. It's a better program, I understand, than Wayne State University's Language Institute, and much less expensive. And very highly skilled instructors, very detailed program, can take people from any level of the language they speak, the foreign language they speak. And of course, there's a limit on how many languages that they can deal with in terms of moving people to English.
It's the same sort of program,
right? But it's quicker, it's more formal, it's many hours a day for maybe, I don't know the length of the program, but 2, 3, 4 weeks in a row. It's like 8 hours a day, as close as they can get to total immersion, you know. And so anyone needing additional help with learning English better a second language coming from a non-English.
We ought to make that a PSA in the program.
Well, we should. And we have a fine, fine program. As I said, some people think it's even a better, more effective program than the huge English Language Institute at Wayne State University. Both are great, but ours cost so much less in terms of tuition, and it is
it's trying to do the same
program.
Thing.
Yes, yes. So we'll get into the, let's work on a PSA for that.
That sounds like, what would we use for music for that?
Well, we'll think of something. Okay, probably something from our world collection.
Right, yeah. Something from China.
Two other headline stories, and we only have about 10 minutes left in the hour. We understand.
Well, we're having fun.
Yeah, we're hoping that the big blues show with Joanne Korczynska is going to be able to start relatively on time. And Joanne's car won't start this morning.
Well, we'll just have to
do
her
cold weather,
show
and she's
for her.
She's waiting for a tow truck to come and see if it can get it started there. So we're gonna. I'll cover some blues in about 10 minutes.
Oh, that's easy.
So. Well, I think I love blues, and
because
I sit in with her.
You
most
probably
time.
Have one CD in the machine now.
No, but they're right across from me here, so I'm gonna grab something. In fact, there's a phone call coming in. So
it's probably Joanne telling us.
Okay, hang on. I'm gonna actually take it on the air. So there, Ned. Why don't you talk about?
Yeah, here's what I wanted to talk about. Well,
you
doing
go ahead.
You know,
hi, this is WHFR, Jay speaking.
I guess the thing I wanted to say is on today's news, the bad news that Circuit City Corporation is going bankrupt. Now, I thought that deserved a couple minutes of talk on our program because those of you that live in our district, which is Dearborn Heights, our local Circuit City store was closed and all of its contents were put into liquidation and a company bought the products. And now we have the feeling that we only have one major kind of store like that. But the sad news today is Circuit City is going completely out of business and 30,000 employees will be let go. Now, you might think that there's a lot of bargains over there to take advantage of, and I'm sure there is. And so you need to, if you have a Circuit City store in your neighborhood, here the ours in Dearborn Heights, of course, is already closed, but there are others around and not too far from us that you can take advantage of in Taylor and in Canton, I believe, in Westland. But that's the bad news, and or good news if you need to buy something and you think there's a sale to take advantage of. Just one thing I'd like to warn you about. I myself made a purchase of a television not too long ago at the very store that went bankrupt and was closed here in Dearborn. However, when you do that and you take a display model, and that means you don't get the product in the box. And when you don't get the box, you don't get the instructions, you don't get the book that goes with it. And so you might want to be careful about that. Now we have Jay's full attention. I was going to tell I told our listening audience the news as I walked in this morning that the Circuit City Corporation has gone bankrupt. Yep. And they're closing their stores, and 30,000 employees will be lost. We already lost our store here in Dearborn.
Right. They've been closing in Michigan for a while, but now it's all nationwide.
Now it's nationwide, yeah, and yeah. I was trying to warn our customers. I made a major purchase at this one here, but when you buy things and that's not in a box and a display model, guess what?
Yeah.
You don't get a lot of the things that are missing in the box.
Yeah,
so you want to be careful about that if you're fussy. I'm told I should go on the internet and maybe I can find a manual or something. So along with every blessing, there's a curse. If you saved a couple $100, now you don't have the book that goes with it. So now Jay got some information over the phone. What did we get?
Unfortunately, a blues man has passed away, and it was Johnny Bassett, one of the great Detroit blues artists, who's calling in. And so in Joanne's show, we'll give him information about the funeral. Joel Gray, not the movie actor. So we'll talk about that later. But thanks to Johnny for calling in about that. We'll share that with our blues listeners later. So this is something that you talked about, sort of like consumer electronics, and in the time we have remaining, which is only 7 minutes here, 2 weeks ago, Susan Morrell, our news director, and myself, we talked about the necessity for getting a converter box for your analog TV. Now, if you have cable TV already or some sort of satellite dish TV, you don't have to worry about what we're saying, but an awful lot of people, something like they believe 7 million households have not gotten a converter box, and on February 17th, when if they proceed according to the guidelines to switch to all digital broadcasting over the air, their old analog TVs will get no signal at all. Okay, unless they
bought the analog TVs work with the box. You don't need a digital TV.
Now,
I think that's a little confusing.
If you bought a new television and you've been just using an antenna of some sort, just a regular antenna, not a satellite dish thing, not a cable connection, but just a regular rabbit ears inside the house, as they used to call them, or an antenna
on
your roof.
External antenna on the roof.
You might actually, if you bought a new TV in the last couple of years, it may have a digital tuner, that is the converter built into it. But it might not. Okay, so you're going to need an analog converter, analog to digital converter box, which costs $40 or more. It could cost more. And this is what happened. In fact, this is interesting.
What happened to the coupons? They ran out, they said.
That's right. January 8th, this story was in the New York Times that Obama's chief of staff to be, Podesta, has said that they've got to stop that February 17th digital switch date because the fund ran out of money. If you have a coupon and you haven't used it yet, the odds are the store won't even accept it because they won't get reimbursed. The U.S. government put out something like $1.3 billion for these coupons, and it's already gone. Okay? And anybody that wants a coupon that goes to the government website and so on. And
can you buy your own with your own money?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
you can put $60 or $80 out, but Obama doesn't think it's fair. Most of these 7.8 million households are low-income folks that don't have the $60 or $80, or there's a chance you might find one for $42 or $43 or something. But as I said, I went to a local store, and I don't want to promote them here, but they took the $40 coupon, and I just had to pay tax. And actually, it was a retail price of like $60 unit, but they just said, "Okay, we're even. You just pay the sales tax, which was $2."
But you have cable. Cents. Why would you need it?
And maybe this happens to a lot of people. A lot of smart people say, "What if cable or dish TV goes down? You get no television. But if you got the box, you wire up the box then, and then you can get at least broadcast TV. So it's a backup for me." Or if I run out of money in my retirement, I can't afford cable anymore. I've got the box. So I've got it as a sort of a backup system, if the cable wiring goes down.
They never told that to the world.
What?
If the cable goes down, you need the box for the broadcast stations.
No, but if it's digital, you do. See, that's right. In the old days, if you still had your antenna, all up to February 17th.
What if you have a completely analog TV?
Then you need the converter box. That's
right. And if it goes out, you're out of luck. I mean, it goes out.
if cable goes out and it's already digital, your analog TV will not get anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have
even people with cable, if you have an analog TV connected to cable, if the cable goes out, you'll get nothing once we become all digital. So that's why I got my coupon, and I got just for $2 tax. I got the
converter. Where'd you get the coupon from? Where do you get coupons from?
You have to go on the internet. Isn't that weird? So if you don't have internet connection, talk about the digital divide here. You see the problem, folks, with these 7.8 million people that can't afford cable, let's say.
They probably can't afford the internet either.
Don't have
a computer.
How are they going to get the coupon? You know?
I never thought about it because I have a digital-ready computer, even though it's 8, 10 years. It says digital right on it.
Yeah, well.
So that means when you have cable, it's going to work with no problem anyway.
If it has a digital tuner. Sometimes manufacturers, they say it's digital ready, but what they mean is it's digital ready if you add an extra converter. Ha ha!
You're right.
It's so they're sort of stretching the truth. But I just wanted to say here, folks, that we told you, you know, go ahead and get those coupons, no problems. Right now, there's a coupon waiting list. So even if you go online, they'll put your name down, but it doesn't mean you get the coupons if they don't have another $200,000 or $300,000.
So I'm planning on selling my television. I better wait till February 7th to see if it works before I pass it to somebody else.
That's right. Another $200-300 million for converter coupons. But Obama's on top of it, and he said, we're just going to delay that and figure out where the money's going to come from to get the coupons. The humorous thing is, we are saved. Dave, Joanne Korczynska has arrived in the studio right on time. So,
and all we have to do is play her theme song.
And we will in 1 minute. Here is a comment. Oh, somebody wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times about this. Okay.
Right.
And
which one is more funny?
Oh, they're both complaining about this situation. See, William Kennard and Michael Powell. Powell used to be the head of the FCC, and Kennard was the head before him. And they wrote an article for the New York Times warning of the train wreck that will ensue if millions of people with analog TV sets temporarily go without television. Well, this person's spin is, he says, and he's Mark Holloway from New York City. He said, I haven't owned a TV in 10 years, so I won't be in any danger, so-called, or get caught up in any fiasco. But I would venture to say that sometime without television, maybe listen to WHFR more, while one waits for a converter box coupon, for example, might foster some reading or even daydreaming. Inexpensive, relatively green, and I dare say, more productive alternatives to, what I'll put in the word, commercial television. And he says, in these troubled times, surely there are more important things to which Congress and our next president can direct their attention and taxpayer money. Well, yeah, but a lot of people live their lives around their TV and, you know, the information they get from it, good or bad. And so we'll see what happens with that. But I just want to let you know is that there's a problem there with those coupons, folks. That's all we have time for. I want to thank Dr. Gelderoos for coming earlier from the U of MD Environmental Interpretive Center.
Very interesting.
And Ned Apigian for sitting in and giving us his very, very significant opinions. Stay tuned for Joanne Korczynska coming up. But, Ned, let's give a plug that your show, the Forum Program, Then and Now, is coming up on the 4th Saturday of this month.
That's right. I remember you saying the 4th Saturday
this
month.
That's right. And whatever the date is, just the 4th Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m., the guest this month is going to be?
Dr. Kochikian from Bentley University in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Yeah,
he's suburb of, we're going to talk about the Georgian war, not so much. We get background into the Georgian people, so if you wonder, what on earth is that all about?
And we're not talking about Atlanta, Georgia.